Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. India won the final test at Ahmedabad by an innings to seal the series 3-1 against England to book their place in the World Test Championship final and return to the top of the ICC Test Team Rankings. We'll be discussing that, England's win in New Zealand, some captaincy news in South Africa, sixes in the West Indies, the PSL postponement and much more. I'm Yaz Rana, and to get through all that with me today is the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner, the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Let's start on the test itself before going into the series as a whole. In the end, England lost by an innings, but at one stage fairly deep into the second day, they were arguably ahead in the test with India 6 down in their first innings, still trailing by 60. And then Rishabh Pant and Washington Sundar, but especially Pant, took the game away from England. It was Pant's third test 100 and yet another decisive contribution this winter. Joe, that final session on the second day was probably the most important of the game, and Pant just took the game completely away from England.
Yeah, he absolutely did. Phil and I were exchanging a couple of messages just after this, and I said to Phil that even though it looked, the scoreline said England were absolutely in the game at that stage, personally, I still didn't really feel like they had a particularly big chance because it just felt like they were going to just be blown away in their second innings and that India would be able to manage to chase whatever target they had. But that said, yeah, Pant was awesome, as he has been for the last 4 or 5 months now. He's already creating a legacy as a special cricketer, and he's only just getting started. England will be pleased to see the back of him for now, but then we'll be seeing plenty more of him this summer, which England bowlers might not be looking forward to, but I think most England fans will be. Even he is going to put England to the sword again.
Yeah, he played that one shot off Jimmy, didn't he? The reverse lap over the slips. That was just incredible. I don't think that, I mean, you're not supposed to do that in Test cricket at all, let alone to a guy with 600 Test wickets, let alone when he's bowling the secondary ball. So, that was sort of like a sort of scales falling from the eyes moment, I think, for anyone who is still doubting how good Rishabh Pant is. But yeah, I really did feel like England were actually in the game, and especially because I kind of felt before the test that they quietly had a chance. You know, that obviously it was only 2-1 and India had kind of, I don't know, the scoreline didn't flatter them, or the results didn't flatter them, but it was England had chances in those first two games as well. Like if England had just given a little bit more of themselves or turned it on just slightly at the right moments in those games, then they would have been quite a lot closer. And then I think India scored more runs in the last session of day two than they had in the first two combined. And yeah, that really was just the real moment when it kind of turned into a tour, when England had kind of kept their heads up, sort of competed to being one of those tours where it kind of all just started falling apart. And that last day batting performance was exactly that kind of sort of end of tour, sort of let's just have a bit of fun and like it'll all be over soon kind of thing.
It just, sometimes in test series you get into what feels like a kind of inescapable rhythm, and it's often when England are playing in Asia. And I just felt by the end of it, I felt like if they'd played another 10 tests, then India probably would have won the series 13-1. Because there's so much of it, obviously there were technical issues in terms of how the batsmen were playing spin, but so much of it was psychological as well. And it was just impossible for me to see how England were going to claw their way back from that. I mean, Ben Stokes played really well in that first innings, I thought. And Dan Lawrence, I guess, is one positive that England can take away from this tour. Not to mention a victory in the first test, but of the latter part of the tour. But I just didn't feel like, as a group, they had anything like enough to really push India. And when you look at the margins of defeat in each of those second, third and fourth tests, we can talk about rotation, we can talk about various other factors, but the fact is England were well beaten by a much better side.
I kind of think, though, that we'll get onto the batsmen in more detail later on, but I kind of wonder how much can you really criticise the England batting group, just because like a lot of very well-established Indian batsmen really struggled as well. No, I know that other than Root, no English batsman averaged more than 25, but other than Sharma and Pant, none of the Indian top six averaged over 30 either. Kohli, Pujara, Rahane and Gill all struggled. It was just a very hard series to bat in, really. And I do think the margin of victory did kind of flatter India a little bit. It was kind of the odd individual standout innings that took England away.
I would say that's fair up to a point. Certainly, Sharma was the standout player across the course of the series and was playing a different kind of game. Of the many reasons why England will kick themselves when the post-mortem gets played out here, Kohli didn't get many runs. I mean, he got 70-odd in the first test match, albeit in a kind of rather futile cause, and then got a couple of blobs and not much else. Now, when you look at the, and the Rahane the same, you know, a nondescript series from a brilliant player. So I think in mitigation, those points are fair and reasonable. And while we don't want to go down the road of the pitches again, the reality was that they were tough places to bat for everybody concerned. That's what made Sharma so special and what makes him so special in Indian conditions. England's mind went, I think somebody said it just now, the collective psyche of the side was shot by the end of it. And as Joe's right, I mean, this happens on long tours away from home in particular. And it's happened here. The real clincher was the second innings of the third test match when Root had taken five for nothing. And you saw the way that they came out to play, and none of them backed themselves to bat for more than an hour. None of them backed themselves technically, defensively. And so they kind of were enveloped in this sort of kamikaze approach. Can somebody maybe stick it out, fluke it for an hour, maybe get to 40-odd and we might be able to set them 120. That was the attitude. And that attitude was the culmination of what had happened for the week or two before that. And that bled into the final test match. Joe Root won three of the four tosses and obviously batted first in each. To have only scrabbled up to 200 on that first day, that pitch was okay. That pitch that in the fourth test was fine. It spun a bit, but it didn't go through the top on the first day very much at all, certainly not appreciably. There was a bit of pace and bounce for the seamers. It was a good cricket wicket. And England's top six, seven, they couldn't rouse themselves. And technically as well, they'd run out of trust in themselves as well, you know. And even Stokes, who did play nicely, the ball that he got out to is the ball that he's got out to all winter, the kind of vaguely non-turning left-arm non-spinner into the non-rough, and he plays back and he misses it. And that seemed to typify where the team were by the end of the series, really. They will still look at that. And it sounds a little bit naff to talk about this, but in a nip-and-tuck series, in a nip-and-tuck test match, and that test match was, until Rishabh took it away from them, And he was out. He was out LB, the final ball before tea, or the final over before tea on that second day. That would have changed the complexion of the game. I'm not saying it would have changed the result, because England was struggling to get to 150 come what may. But it would have changed the complexion of the game, and it would have given India something to chase on that final innings, as it was. I think the energy, the life just sucked out of them at that moment. And poor old Don Bess, covered in clarts from head to toe, desperate for a break. Hadn't bowled well, but you know, he's plucky and he's a cricketer that you warm to for that. And he just needed a break. And that LB that wasn't given, well, they will look back at that and think that was the hinge moment of the game, really.
Just on England's issues against spin, watching them collapse again in that second innings of the most recent test, it reminded me of I spoke to Ben Duckett in, must have been September 2016, just before we went to Bangladesh and India that winter, and he was picked because he'd scored mountains of runs that season for Northants, but also because he was regarded as one of the best players of spin in the country. And I remember speaking to him, and he was understandably confident going into that tour, and he told me that playing spin was his strength, and he was right. He wasn't trying to put a fast one, that's what he felt. And in county cricket he was, but in the context of batting against Ravi Ashwin in the subcontinent, saying you're a good player of spin in county cricket is like saying you're a good player of swing and seam bowling, but you've only ever faced it in the nets. It's just a completely different thing that you're encountering. And Duckett, you'll remember, was terrorised by Ashwin, dismissed by him every time he faced him, dropped, and hasn't played test cricket since. And Ben Duckett is still one of the best players of spin in the country, but it's a stretch to believe that he would have fared much better than the batsman who struggled in this latest tour. And these are players like Zach Crawley, Ollie Pope. We're talking about these as special batting talents, and yet they really, really struggled. And I think you're right, Yaz. I think we can't blame them too much, partly because of the pitches, but more just because of where they're coming from and the experience they've had against spin bowling.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The frustration for England will be, you mentioned them, Pope and Crawley are the totems of English batting for the next 5 years. This is how people are seeing it, and understandably so, I think. But they've A, faced no kind of quality, as you say, Joe, but B, the frustration will be that when Cook went to India as a greenhorn and when Root went to India as a greenhorn, they both made runs immediately, and there was something innate in their approach that enabled them to circumnavigate the complexities of batting in India, batting in the subcontinent. The frustration has been that neither of these two, who you were hoping would play one defining innings, say, in eight innings. And okay, Crawley played nicely for 50, but that was against the seamers. And I don't think he's been out against seams since the middle of last summer or something like that. So the frustration will be that there were very few indications that either of them had begun to crack the puzzle. Now, there are many examples of some great players who firstly never cracked the puzzle, but who certainly took a while to crack the puzzle. And the obvious one to go to is Ponting. But Ponting, even after 14 test matches in India, only ever averaged 26 across 15 years of test cricket. So it is an unquestionably challenging job, even for the very, very best. Crawley and Pope, you hope and believe, will get more chances. And it will happen again. And you hope that they will improve and fail better and fail again and fail a bit better and so on and so on. Crawley's approach was garbled. I mean, he was caught mid-off twice in seven or eight innings. There's a hell of a lot for them to have to assess now. And I think the genie's out of the bottle up to a point with regards to the county setup. There's been so much talk now around the prevalence of seam above spin and the importance of recognising and respecting spin a little bit more. That needs to start to change now over the next few years. Or else we will continue to be having these conversations year after year.
Yeah, I think the thing that's hard for me is actually looking at who's improved as a player of spin over this tour, and it doesn't feel like anyone has really, if anything, and Phil feels really right to point out that they were kind of spooked by the fourth test, by what happened in the second and the third. Like, after doing so well in Sri Lanka, they kind of went into that first test all with a game plan, with a method that they kind of trusted, that they knew that they could kind of, like, on a pitch that would allow them to bat long, that they could, like, back themselves to do that. And then by the end, you know, you had Pope sort of trying to kind of dance down the track frenetically, kind of every single ball. You had Stokes playing sort of fine sweeps to first slip. You had, you know, like, it didn't seem like any of them were any closer to cracking the puzzle either. It's not like, you know, on that 2012 tour, Bell and Trott had kind of struggled against spin that whole year in Pakistan and in Sri Lanka earlier. And then by the end had kind of sort of shown enough to get hundreds in that final test. And that progression didn't seem evident, which I think will be slightly worrying. And yeah, if England had kind of, in a way, if the surfaces had been reordered in this series, if that fourth test surface had come in the second test and England had won the toss, I think they would have backed themselves to play the same way and had much, much better results, whereas they kind of just expected another spinning top, didn't realise quickly enough that it wasn't that, and then were kind of really, although you can point to, you know, they bowled really well up till Pant took the game away and say they could have been in the game, that only makes that batting performance on the first day even more lamentable, really, because, like, they could have got up to 300 and then they would have been properly in the game even when, you know, hadn't played a freak of an innings on day two.
Yeah, I kind of think that because England travel to Asia so infrequently, I mean, they've only played in Sri Lanka in the last 4 or 5 years before this tour, that generalisations are made about how to play in Asia and how to play spin based off quite limited experience on specific surfaces against specific bowlers. So, for example, the pitches are just a little bit different in Sri Lanka to India. England probably haven't really played on any surfaces like the Ahmedabad pitches in the last 5 years. And, you know, if you succeed against Rangoona, Herath and Dilrawan Pereira, that doesn't necessarily mean that just because India also have a left-arm spinner and off-spinner, that's going to work against Axel Patel and Ravi Chandranashwin, who are much taller, get the ball to bounce a little bit more. I thought it was quite interesting that England's success against spinner the last few years has not relied upon, but a lot of it's been based around sweeping a lot, and India don't really sweep, and they're the home side, and I think that's quite telling, and especially it's harder to sweep against bowlers that tall. So I kind of wonder if the success in Sri Lanka, winning those five tests in a row in Sri Lanka in the last 2 years, might have actually hindered England a little bit in kind of lulling them into thinking that this was the blueprint for success with a bat in Asia. And the other thing I'd say is that Strauss made the point that you made, Phil, on TV about how some English players in the past have just done well against spin from day one. But Crawley and Pope just didn't really have the surfaces with which you could kind of learn on it. You couldn't, it was very difficult to just kind of get through a period, and then learn on the job, which what these guys kind of have to do because they don't face anything like that in England.
Yeah, just I agree with that entirely. Just one thing on Pope, because we don't want to just casually and lazily throw him into that box necessarily as being out of his depth in these conditions, foreign and alien as they are. For a couple of hours on that first day, I thought Pope played quite nicely and then was out in a freakish manner, caught off his back pad, off his back leg, looping up to short leg. It looked like he had begun to figure it out a little bit. He was Michael Clarking it. He was running down the pitch every other ball, trying to get to the half volley and punch it up to mid on. And it looked like he was beginning to figure it out slowly. He was also Ashwind a couple of times beautifully in the pink ball test. I mean, they were a couple of absolute jaffers that are spinning on, was shooting off the pitch, but rather unusually so, as that graphic in the fourth test showed us. That the pink ball was skidding on far more than the red. But look, overall, we can make grand statements about the culture, and they're all grounded in reality. The slight brackets, the aside, I suppose, is that Dan Lawrence looked like he'd figured out a way to play in that final test match. Maybe we'll come to him in a bit. But as the game is funneled more and more to the top of this pyramid and this big three thing, unofficially or otherwise, England will be playing a lot of test cricket against India over the next 10 to 12 years. And the likes of Crawley, Pope and Lawrence and Hamid and Duckett and all of these kinds of youngish players still, if we really do want to genuinely go out there and compete and compete on relatively level terms, then there has to be a sea change of attitudes and approach in our county game. We touched on it last week on the show. I think we should touch on it more as we move through the season. The big hope is that the conference system, the three divisions of six, may actually change the approach and attitudes of captains and coaches at county level and bring spinners through a little bit more and expose them, expose batsmen to real good quality spin on fourth day pitches. And even in England, it spins on the fourth day. So there are things to address, no question about it. And we haven't even got to the rotation policy yet.
We don't need to get into that. I think we've talked about that enough this series.
I want to. Did you see the story in the Mail on Sunday that Root has broken ranks? Did you see this? Well, so Root has come clean on it through the Mail on Sunday. No longer will a big marquee test series under his watch be so upended by this rest and rotation policy, which may, albeit, be an anomaly because of the times that we're living in, and may not apply quite as much this time next year, say. However, having bitten his lip for the last 2 months, Root could bite it no longer. And Joe made this point before the series even started. Penny for Joe Root's thoughts regarding the rotation thing. Well, now we know what those thoughts are. He's got on with it as best he can, but it's been a real struggle for him as a leader.
It's worth recording. I mean, they made four changes to a winning side after the first test of a series in India. I mean, how many times has that happened in the history of test cricket for the underdog who's won the first test to make four changes? That it's an almost impossible task to win from that point onwards. And look, I don't think they'd have won the series anyway. I don't think Butler being there rather than being at home would have won them the series, but I think it might have made it a little bit closer. But you know, I have a lot of sympathy for Root. I think that the schedule is ridiculous. I mean, they can't do all these things, and I do feel like there was an element that they thought they couldn't win in India. So yeah. We'll prioritise other things, and that's a depressing state of affairs if that is the case. And rather, they've added more test matches. I mean, we're all looking forward to New Zealand and England this summer. But those test matches shouldn't have been added to the schedule, really. It's just too much cricket. And in the end, it will be the players and the fans that suffer, the fans that are frustrated they're not seeing the best of the players, and the players who are frustrated because they're either not playing or they're playing too much or they're being rested from games that they were desperate to play in. And the whole thing is a bit of a mess. And I think that, I mean, you'd say greed is at the heart of it, apart from due to COVID. I guess there is a lot of money that needs to be clawed back. So I wouldn't want to be too harsh on that, but there's too much in there.
Yeah, and I think that the New Zealand series it's tough as well because of just how good New Zealand are. If this was, you know, Bangladesh or someone England could sort of reliably believe themselves to be able to compete if they picked a slightly weakened side, then you'd have, you know, more sympathy for the scheduling in that case. But considering that, you know, so the IPL schedule's come out and it ends 3 days before that series starts, I think. So it seems pretty likely that if England players make the later stages, then they won't be available for that test series. And it's going to be, I mean, it'll be hard to beat New Zealand anyway, you know, second best side in the world in that World Test Championship final with a team who are very capable in these conditions, as they've shown before. And Joe Root is at some point going to start being judged on these results. And so much of it is just out of his control. You know, if he's being deprived of it could be four first choice players that he's missing for that series, or close first choice, three or four, I guess, depending on what you consider Moeen Ali at that stage. And that's, you know, that's a tough thing. And especially as you're right, he has had to kind of not really talk about the impact of it because of, you know, being an ECB employee and wanting to toe the line and that sort of thing. And I actually wrote a piece on wisdom.com looking at what the impact of the rotation policy is. I think it's hard to sort of describe the policy's effect in the second test too much because, I mean, Butler was the big player to miss out, but Ben Folkes had a very good game in that second test. So I think that test was probably, you know, that you can just put that down to India being so good. But that third test is a real missed opportunity. And especially if we consider that a big impact in that was England's team combination, the fact that, you know, they bowled seam for so long on the first evening when it was actually a game dominated by spin. If the rotation policy hadn't been in place and Moeen Ali had been around, obviously there's loads of things going to this, but that's where the big impact was, where if Moeen Ali had been picked for that test and they had two spinners and you rely on that spin for a bit more and you also have the batting depth, I think that's the game where you can say there might well have been an impact there. I know it's a 10-wicket win in the end, but if England had clawed up to a set in India 150, then that could have been a very different contest. And I think that's the one they'll look back on, really, is the missed opportunity as much as the fourth test. At some point, I think, I mean, it's hard to think, when have England had as hard a home summer as this one facing, would they ever have faced the two best teams in the world across seven tests in a summer before? I can't think of that happening.
Not in a long time.
And to do that with, you know, a semi-weakened team and a team without playing a lot of first-class cricket for some of them is a very hard ask, and it is going to be tough on Root, I think.
Yeah, and this is the winter. Let's be frank. This is the winter when the IPL finally assumed that primacy in the priority list of the top echelon players. If any of, and look, I'm not sitting in judgment here, but if any of Stokes, Bairstow, Moeen, et al. Had said, I'm going to forego it because this test series right here is the most important, the be-all and end-all of my winter's cricket, then we wouldn't be discussing this thing. This is the winter when all the variables aligned, and England's top brass, top echelon players, had the misfortune to be on tour in India minutes before the IPL started. And while all the caveats are necessary about COVID and the strains and stresses of being in these bubbles cannot be underestimated, but the brutal truth is that this was the winter. This was the winter when all of those concerns that had been percolating around for many years before finally came home to roost, and an England test team was severely hindered and affected as a consequence of the power and the persuasiveness of the IPL. And that's just unavoidable. That's an unavoidable byproduct of this winter.
Yeah, and then we should just acknowledge, well, that England's, in a way, almost bargaining position, if you want to call it that, is weakened because, you know, these players have had to accept pay cuts in recent times, so that they can't sort of, and whereas, you know, IPL deals are as valuable as ever, there hasn't been a reduction in value of those. So I think that, and you know, I don't think anyone's judging players here for making personal choice. I think we're just commenting on what the reality of those choices are and mean, which is that, yeah, the IPL is almost now the most important thing for a cricketer, and maybe that's fine, but it's also the case, I think.
Your moment of the week was that Lawrence Knott. Ben wrote something for the website kind of imagining how England try and get all their batsmen into a top six, top seven for that summit, assuming everyone's available. Ben, how do you think that England might manage that?
Well, I personally think they sort of shouldn't try and manage that, I think. Because obviously the temptation is to want to pick, you know, all of Pope, Lawrence, Butler, maybe Folks, maybe Sam Curran back in England. But I think that, you know, we've seen so many times for England recently when they've tried to sort of take one of their mid-order or lower mid-order players and sort of shove them into that number three role, and it hasn't worked, basically. That was the winter of, when would it have been, 2018-19, when they had five number threes and six test matches. You know, Ben Stokes over one innings, it was a quite silly situation. And I think Ollie Pope is the one, I think, that they'll look at and think, is he ready to move up to number three? And he might be at some point, but he's just not yet. His, like, his development is taking probably longer than England would have hoped as a test cricketer, but equally, that shouldn't come as too great a surprise. You know, there's lots of players that have taken this long to sort of really sort of find their game and to properly prove that they can kind of crack it and have gone on to have successful test careers. So I don't think it's any damning indictment of Pope that he isn't yet ready to be a number three. But I think that for the moment, basically, I think there's a slot to be won, essentially. I mean, it could be that Rory Burns tears it up in the start of the county summer and comes back to open and probably goes back down to number three. Or it could be that there's a county batsman, could be, you know, a Dawid Malan, it could be someone like that who sort of comes in and stakes a claim. But I would be against pushing up a Pope or a Lawrence or even a Ben Stokes to number three just so you can fit all those players in, because we've seen how specialised a position that is at first drop. And you're kind of, it's not really a solution if the player that you're putting up there is unsuited to the role and therefore doesn't perform. That's not really a solution at all, in my opinion.
Ben, presumably with Pope, you're saying, you're not saying he's unsuited to the role and that he won't be able to fulfil it ever. It's not against his style. It's just a lack of experience in that position yet.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, because you know, for all his promise, he averages, what, just over 30 in test cricket at the moment. And that falls down to 23 in the last 12 months. I think he is struggling a bit at the moment. Not that England shouldn't show faith, but I just think that show of faith shouldn't extend to asking him to, you know, sit in the most important position in the batting order yet, I think. And, you know, maybe that changes if he goes back to Surrey and says, can I bat number three? And then,
well, this is
409 games. But
this is what I was going to say. I mean, you pointed out before we started that there are nine rounds of county championship games before the first test of the summer. I think Pope should bat three for Surrey. I mean, Surrey's batting lineup has not exactly been firing. I think they could do with him there. And we know Pope's record in county cricket is astonishing, kind of right up there with the very best in first-class cricket, domestic first-class cricket of all time. So I think he should bat three. He could easily have a couple of tons by the time the first test rolls around. And then he probably is quite a good option to bat three, because I don't think there are a huge, you talk about being a specialist role, but the problem is they don't have that many people in that role to fill that position. So that's what I'd be thinking if I was Pope. And I think he's had a tough winter, but I think we shouldn't forget the innings he played in South Africa, what he's done in county cricket. He's still very much going to be part of England's future. And yeah, I could easily see him batting at three in the not too distant future.
It's worth bearing in mind that the final test match of last summer, a lad went out batting at three and got 267. So it's not unreasonable to think that Crawley may just slip back into that role in England. The experiment of opening him over the winter, I think personally, I thought made sense. But I think we've seen that he's, you know, he has his issues against spin in a way that he certainly doesn't against seam. So there's every chance that Crawley just slips back in there and Lawrence sits on the bench. And I think that's fine. I think that's fair. I mean, the kid's only just getting going anyway. The more expansively attacking move would be to open with Crawley to main, you know, I know that he's done it successfully before and he started his test career as an opener. So it's possible that they could do that and bring Joe's, as ever, sensible regarding Pope. Stokes is another option. Stokes is an intriguing option. And if Stokes is going to bowl less and less, then you can theoretically, he has the game to bat three. He also has the tempo to bat three in an attacking team. It's offset by how important he is in that middle section with some youngish players potentially around him. But then again, if Butler is developing properly and is now comfortable at test level and he's at seven, then maybe you don't need Stokes at five quite so critically. there's all kinds of permutations. But when it comes to Lawrence, who my sense is that, firstly, I was surprised that he got to play in that final test match. I wasn't really expecting that to happen. And I thought we would end up with Lawrence having had a taste of it without really having shown too much, that 70 in the first test match. The way that he batted in that final game does throw it off kilter a little bit, because he showed that he had the temperament and the balls to do it in a horrible pressure cooker, futile situation. And he played nicely across both innings there. So that might turn England's head a little bit. I can see Lawrence in a bizarre kind of face-off type fashion, actually fulfilling a kind of Collingwood-like role in this England side at 5 or 6, despite batting obviously nothing like him, but doing that kind of role where the other players work around him. I can see that being a nice role for Lawrence down the line in this England side. There's all kinds of permutations. My instinct is that Lawrence won't get the nod initially. And batting at Chelmsford, he's not going to walk into that first test match with 400 or 500s under his belt. So my instinct is that he'll probably be in the squad, but sitting on the bench initially.
Yeah, but I think that as much as we talk about the players that are currently in the team, I think there will be a lot of county players looking at that number 6 position, feeling that it hasn't been nailed down, and looking at that number 3 position also, and feeling that there might be, and the opener's position, and feeling that there's more reward than there might normally be for having a, you know, the right one to form at the right time this summer, I think, especially with so much county cricket before that first test match. I wouldn't rule out someone that we haven't really discussed too much, like possibly a Joe Clark, someone like that, making a real case for that first test against New Zealand. I can see that happening, even if, you know, it feels like England have such an array of options at the moment.
Yeah, and Sibley's played 18 test matches now and has made a single figure score in the first innings of half of them. This is across all kinds of different conditions. I like Dom Sibley a lot as a bloke, and I like to see the way that he goes about it. I like his industriousness, his resourcefulness, but there are concerns there, unavoidable concerns there. Rory Burns, again, we were collectively lauding having two good old-fashioned, one right, one left opening batsmen a year or so ago. And now they are both in the spotlight, let's be fair. And so, you know, a Will Rhodes-type player to break out in those early months of the season undoubtedly then does throw those opening spots and the number 3 spot up for grabs. This is often the way it is. Come the end of a grueling winter, suddenly everything's up for grabs. We haven't even mentioned Johnny Bairstow, by the way. We haven't even mentioned him at all. Joe, is that experiment finished?
I think so. Well, I only really thought he should be recalled because he was such a good player of spin. But then we got a reminder that, like most English players, when the ball's turning like that, they do struggle. Look, I don't know. I mean, it was a pretty miserable experience, wasn't it? With a bit of optimism after Sri Lanka and then the whole situation, which we don't need to go back into, about him going home, which was all, yeah, supposedly for the benefit of his mental health. I don't think he can be feeling particularly great at this time. And it would have been a really difficult period for him. I don't see him playing Test cricket again, personally.
No, me neither, really. I was surprised, but behind it. I like the theory, the thinking of this being a kind of a one-off winter. Hasn't worked. And I think now it will be sensible of them to recognise that he offers a lot in white ball cricket, but in red ball cricket there are other better options.
Just one name to mention, and Ben brings him up fairly regularly, but I think you might have just mentioned now, actually, but David Milan, I think, is one worth keeping an eye on early weeks of the season. He had a brilliant start for Yorkshire last summer, right up there in the top of the averages. And also, he's got the kind of handy Ashes century in his back pocket, which, as we get towards that squad, is going to count for quite a lot, I think. And he hasn't gone to Yorkshire to finish off his county career. He's gone to Yorkshire to win back his England spot. He's fiercely ambitious. And even though these things shouldn't really matter because they're such different formats, his stock as an international batsman has risen hugely based on what he's done in T20 cricket, which I think does have an impact to a degree. So I think he's one worth keeping your eye on over the kind of the first couple of months of the county season.
And while we're here, let's all do the Haseeb dance. Let's all do the Haseeb Ahmed jig. Vice-captain now at Notts. Who's to say? Gets a couple of hundreds early doors, we'll be all in, won't we? You know that we will.
I always find it the start of a county championship series after England have had a bad winter. not saying that England had a bad winter, but when England haven't done great, it's just so much more exciting because there are so many players who, some of whom are not on the radar at all. Somebody could have 400s by mid-May and suddenly they're right in discussion. And equally, some people can bat their way out of the team as well. Like out of the guys that we mentioned, somebody could average 23 after 8 rounds and suddenly somebody we assume is a shoo-in, at least for a spot in the squad, could be completely out of the picture.
I wonder if just the Bairstow thing is just worth dwelling on slightly longer. It's kind of like a parable for England's almost test fortunes and like from a wider perspective, because in the abstract, I don't think there's anything in a way stopping him from coming again as a test cricketer, in that, you know, he's shown he can do it before and he's shown that he can kind of like adapt his technique to sort of white ball cricket, test cricket, to fit as an hour and to overcome sort of like a technical issue. But he's just never going to get the time, as I see it, to have that sort of 8-game county stint along with working alongside coaches away from like the spotlight to just rectify that issue that he does have against straight bowling in particular, that was kind of opened up after he moved up to white ball cricket. And so, and he's another one actually that, although he's wouldn't exactly be in the frame for a test call up, if he were to just have one season where it's like, I'm not going to do the IPL this year, I'm going to have 9 games for Yorkshire, I'm going to really just work on that one specific issue, I could see that having almost like a transformative impact on his game. And I just don't think it's ever going to happen. Basically, the cards just aren't going to fall that way for him. And that's fine. He's going to go down as one of England's best ever white ball players. But that's almost, I think there's a world where that's all it would take for Bairstow, I think, because we know how good he has been before. And we know how good he kind of still is in white ball cricket. And I don't think it would almost take that much for him to become a test class batsman again. But I also don't think that it's going to happen, I guess.
I've got a question for any and all of you. Of all of these names, and there is one other actually that we haven't even mentioned, of all of these names, if you could guarantee that one of them makes 500s by the first test match and demands that they're in that squad, demands that they're in that 11 of these batsmen that we're talking about, who are you going with, Joe, first of all?
I would go with Oddy Pope.
Right.
I think he's got the most to offer, so I want him in the best form.
Yes.
Pope and Crawley.
And Ben?
Yeah, sorry, I was going to say Pope as well, so I'll change it to not be boring. I guess I'll say Hamid, even though if he did make 500s, I might still end up cautioning against him being recalled at that stage.
Well, the most natural number three of the lot is James Vince. So if he strums 500s for Hampshire by the end of May, then I'm in. I'm all in on that one. Moving on, before I get too much grief.
Going back to the test match itself, one of the reasons England struggled in that final session was that they went into that test, as Phil alluded to, a bowler light, a bowler less than they normally go into a test match with. We semi-seriously considered this possibility on last week's pod. And I think it's fair to say we were all a bit surprised by the eventual selection. Dom Best came back in for one of the seamers and Dan Lawrence came in for one of the others. Did you have a problem with that balance, or was it the personnel involved? I mean, they ended up fielding an out-of-form 23-year-old spinner on a crucial test where it was expected to turn from day one. There are a few quick stats about Best floating about the number of full tosses he bowled, but they didn't tell you anything that your eyes couldn't. How do you think that he ended up playing? Because we often hear about players who are deemed unselectable. I thought it was actually painful watching Best at times, really, really struggling, especially on that second day.
It was really, really tough to watch. And I think it was particularly tough because a lot of people saw it coming. So I think everyone was ready to watch his first over, fearing it might go that way. And it did right from the start. There's a kind of chicken or egg thing going on here. Was his confidence crushed by being dropped after the first test when he didn't bowl that well, but did take wickets? Or actually, was he unselectable after that first test because he bowled so poorly in the second innings? And what we didn't see was he bowling poorly in the nets. Now, Joe Root can't come out and say, well, we can't pick Dom Best because he's bowling like a drain. I mean, it's happened in the past. Ashley Giles famously described Stephen Finn as unselectable, and that really hit Finn and stayed with him for a long time, and we never really saw the best of him again. So I have a lot of sympathy with how England were trying to manage that situation. I think they probably just took a punt and thought, well, you know what, he's not bowled particularly well quite a few times for England, but he's always taken wickets. Let's just see how he goes. And they didn't really, frankly, have that many other options by that stage. Are you going to throw in one of the kids who's not even part of that full squad? They'd already got burnt by not playing enough spinners in the previous game. So as ever, when you get to the end of these tours in the subcontinent, it feels like England's options are suddenly very limited. Either players aren't playing well enough to be picked, or you're playing players that you don't expect to do particularly well because you don't feel like you've got the other options.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but and we don't know how Bess was bowling in between his two test appearances, but he was bowling at least one full toss and over, really. And if that's the case, you kind of think, just like, anyone's better than that. You know, surely one of the uncapped guys would, you think, offer more. And on those kind of pitches, just like, even if you're just like landing it semi-consistently, you're going to cause some kind of trouble.
Yeah, easy being wise after the event and all of that. But Amaverdi was with the squad, and I know one or two others as well. If this had been a seamer, if this had been a Stephen Finn, then there would have been more flexibility, I think, to bring in a bolter, you know, a seamer, like an Ollie Stone type person at that point in his career. But for whatever reason, because of the nature of spin and the raw inexperience of most of our spinners, young spinners, then it always seemed like a jump too far, I think, to have brought him in. The real choker for England would have been seeing balls fly past the nose and being taken by Pant in front of his face from the seamers on that first day. There was pace in that pitch. And so then to have Stone and Archer and Broad both all sitting on the Judy Dench, I mean, that was a real killer for them, I think. Because that pitch would have actually suited the makeup of their team for the first couple of days. As it was by that point, they were done. Just on poor Don Bess's tendency for the full toss, this is a mental thing without a doubt, because it pockmarks the opening ball of a number of his spells and sometimes the first ball of an over as well, until he gets himself into the over. He tends to finish an over better than he starts it at the moment. And that is a psychological thing. That is purely a mental thing. And he's, as I said earlier, he's a really wholehearted cricketer. And yeah, it's been quite tough to watch. I do think that they like him. And I do think that they have faith in him. And he is young and he needs a good year with Yorkshire, bowling on unresponsive pitches, but getting to know how to go about his game. And I do think he will feature again for England. I don't think that was a make or break moment for him. And I hope it wasn't, because it would be a shame to lose a plucky cricketer like that.
And there was kind of further discomfort added to the whole narrative in that Root was so obviously the better option to be bowling at that point. But then as captain, did he want to destroy Bess's confidence by saying, like, basically saying, look, you're not doing the job, I'm going to do it myself. And Root probably bowled Bess too long and didn't bowl himself enough, but I can absolutely see why he did that. And that was, it was kind of unfortunate that he was the captain in that situation. Yeah. Because it was would have been him saying, I'm taking the ball.
If there's one vignette from this series to take away, one visual moment from this series, it is day one, second test, Moeen Ali bowling a mixture, because he hasn't bowled in months, and clean bowling Kohli through the gate with an all-time Jaffa. On a day when he goes at 4.5, 5 and over, and England kind of lose the game on that first day, as Sharma's bat does the talking and Moeen can't quite keep it together. However, that moment sums up England's winter for me. An absolute Jaffa by a bowler who would have had a lot to say in Test matches 3 and 4, but was home comfortably before that third one even began.
We've talked about what English cricket to do to produce more spinners and better prepare their batsmen for spin. I think one thing that is just like quite damning of the predicament that England are in is that you're only one spinner, kind of like the prime years of their career, was in the squad, really. So there's one, Jack Leach was the only spinner who toured, who was born between 1987 and 1996. Four of the spinners who went were 24 or under. Then you had Jack Leach and Moeen Ali. So I get that there weren't ready-made replacements there, but, you know, it's quite damning that England didn't actually have anyone kind of like age 28 who they thought could just do a job in a test match. Let's talk about the Indian spinners. Ashwin ended up with the Player of the Series award, taking 32 wickets at 14, as well as getting that 100 at Chennai. Axar Patel ended up with 27 wickets at 10.59. Ben, can you remember a debut series as good as that with the ball? And then, do you think he's actually going to play again the next time India play a test match? Or even a test match?
Can I remember a debut series that good with the ball? No, is the short answer, basically. And we should actually you know, as much we can talk about England's deficiencies playing spin, as much we can talk about the pitches, he was just brilliant, and especially brilliant just at understanding immediately how to bowl on the pitches that he came up, that he was faced with, and the balls that he was faced with bowling with. Like, he wouldn't have bowled with a pink ball much in his career, and yet knew instantly that it was that sort of that quicker straighter one mixed with sort of the sharp turning one that was going to just give him like huge rewards, and it did. So yeah, that was brilliant. Yeah, he's very unlikely he's playing the World Test Championship final. India might just go in with one spinner, and even if they go in with two, Jadeja will be fit by then, and you'd think it'd be Jadeja and Ashwin. And yeah, he's going to have a hard time fighting past Jadeja, because they're very similar bowlers, really. They're not just left-arm spinners. As you were saying earlier, yes, there's spin bowlers and there's spin bowlers. There's many different types, but him and Jadeja are both that kind of darting, accurate, quick type. And so they offer very similar things to England's attack, to India's attack. Whereas, so I think that even if India are going in with three spinners in the future, we also didn't see much of him with the bat, although supposedly he can bat a bit. But if India's first choice are Ashwin and Jadeja, who can both bat as well, then I think, yeah, fighting past them is going to be very difficult. But, you know, Jadeja will be around forever. And he could well, you know, we've seen Ashwin and Jadeja also kind of dovetail for form and kind of come in and out of the side. I don't think it's out of the question that in a few years' time, we're actually Patel's back in the side and is, you know, on his way to, you know, to filling that hole very capably, I think. So, yeah, he was absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
There a thought for Shahbaz Nadeem. Do you remember him from, what, yeah, 4 weeks ago? 2 for 233. Unlikely to be seen in Test cricket again, I'd have thought. Bowling on a flat one. And then he watches Axel Patel come in and do what he did over the next few Tests. I'm not saying Shahbaz would have done exactly the same. But also, spare a thought for Ravi Jadeja, who might have enjoyed bowling on those surfaces. He might have averaged even fewer than Axel Patel.
Well, I remember saying with absolute conviction a month and a half ago, oh, Jadeja's going to be a big miss, lads. You listen to me. That flat, darting left-arm spin. Without Jadeja, England are going to have a proper chance. And then they just found Jadeja times seven. So it's quite impressive, really.
You were both very right and very wrong.
yeah, that sums it up.
We've had quite a few questions asking about how good we think India are. Stephen C. asks, are we on the brink of a West Indies-Australia-style period of total domination from India? And we had a couple of questions asking who we thought would win the series in England this summer. Phil, let's go to you. What do you think?
We talked about this a month or two ago. I think there will be waves and peaks and troughs. I don't see there being a sustained period a la Australia's 16 wins in a row or the West Indies decade and a half, two decades of dominance, because there are variables at work and because there's some good cricket teams around. However, I think that India will be the preeminent team for a fair old while from here onwards, as they have been really for the last few years anyway. And that home record before England punctured it, albeit for a week, is extraordinary to have lost one test match in 8 years or whatever it was. As for this summer, I think India will win the series. Yeah, I do. And people have said this in the build-up to England-India series before in England. And invariably, England win the clutch moments and then win the series. I think this time round, I think with everything that India has, and I think with that pace attack, that emergent pace attack, I think they are primed for it. I really do. I think they're ready for it. And I think as much as England will never admit it in public, all of their energies are now governed to Australia next winter. And I think India can slip in there. They'll be fresh because they'd have played the World Test Champs final. They'd have played enough county stuff as well. So their players will be focused. It won't be that they'll be flying in 48 hours before that first Test match. And I think it'll be a humdinger, but I fancy India to edge it 3-2, 3-1, something like that.
So I would still have England as marginal favourites, mainly just because I think there are question marks over most of the Indian top six, top seven. I would just have England as favourites. But Phil, if you think India are favourites, if they do win that, having beaten Australia in Australia, then beating England in England the next year, that those are two of the biggest challenges they're going to face in Test cricket. So they are going to go on a very long run without losing a series, if that's the case, and building up a kind of record that stands up against the very best test sides that have ever played the game.
Yeah, indeed. Even for the asterisk of that previous Australia tour with the Steve Smith, Warner stuff, they have still gone to Australia now and won 2-2, which is extraordinary. But they haven't won in England since 2008. So that's really the key. If they can get over that last frontier, if you like, then regardless of what New Zealand do to them in June, they will be out there on their own. The question is how much daylight they can build up from themselves to the chasing pack. It will be fascinating to see how it all plays out. But you look at the depth of what of their talent, and you look at the good arrogance that they have. You know, the kind of arrogance you want in your sports teams and in your individuals. The kind of arrogance that Australia had in the past. The kind of arrogance that West Indies had in the past. There's that brilliant quote, incidentally, from Viv that's just come out that Chris Cowdrey mentioned. It appeared on Twitter when Chris Cowdrey turns up in his blazer for the toss with Viv Richards, and he's head to toe in his finery, and Viv turns up in a Bob Marley t-shirt, and Chris Cowdrey starts reading out the team that he's going to play in this proud test match. Chris Cowdrey's captain of. And he gets four players down, and Viv says, "Oh, don't worry about it. It doesn't make any difference anyway." And then shakes his hand. Now, that was the story of them. Australia under Waugh and Ponting speaks for itself. And now they are beginning India to echo those kinds of eras of dominance. The nature of cricket is that I struggle to see it being blanket dominance. But by the same token, I struggle to see India ever falling back into the pack. They're just too strong, too vast, too powerful, and they know it. That's the key. They know it.
Yeah, I suppose, Phil, it's almost an inversion of that Viv Richards thing, where with India, it doesn't matter who we pick, we're going to win. Like they've won in Australia and in India with such sort of contrasting lineups, with, you know, newbies coming in and taking wickets and scoring runs straight away. I think India have as good a chance as they've sort of ever had, and I think that. The depth in that pace tack especially is key. And we saw Siraj's working over of Joe Root on day one of the fourth test match was complete. And, you know, on a pitch that, sure, it was bouncing a bit. It was reasonably useful for seam, but that's conditions where if Joe Root would back himself to not be like a completely defeated by a seam bowler. And Siraj did that. So that's huge for India. And, you know, it might even be that he's sort of first choice by the time that series rolls around in England. He looks like he could be a very capable bowler there. And then, you know, they've got Umesh Yadav as well. So they've got a sort of a battery of quicks, really, that means that even if there's a bit of injury, a bit of loss of form, they can back themselves to take 20 English wickets reasonably cheaply. The question is just over that, over the batting order, and especially obviously Rohit Sharma and Pant. So Pant, we know, can bat in England. We know he's sort of a generational talent. I think he might well have a big role to play. But Rohit Sharma has... You know, he's got this weakness to the ball that moves in off the seam. He's got this hugely contrasting difference between his home record and his away record. So him doing this well in the home test series was huge for India, but in a way it wasn't surprising. And we still don't know a huge amount about how Suraj is going to be in England. I mean, you sort of fancy that he's got the sort of the technique and the ability to crack it, but he might not. And then the core of that lineup for so many years is Pujara, Rahane and Kohli, and each of them averages, I think, less than 30 since the start of last year. Kohli hasn't got a 100 in any format since 2019. Rahane's got that, obviously got that one at the MCG, but since then it's all, and either side of that has really struggled. And Pujara's kind of batting all day a lot of the time, but isn't scoring any runs. And if the others aren't batting around him, then that's only of limited effectiveness. So I think if one of those three, I think, comes back to form properly, then India have a really good chance. But as it stands with those, I think England will just look at that batting lineup and think that James Anton with a ball that suits him and Stuart Broad and Chris Wokes, they will fancy themselves to still be able to get England over the line. But yeah, it'll be a really, really good one, I think.
Okay, I hear all of that. And your point, especially about Pujara and Rahane, is a fair one, very fair one. Kohli, I don't think that really counts. Yeah, I mean, great players are allowed to be struggling for 5 minutes. Sharma, I'll say it now, probably wrong. I think Sharma will play and score runs in England. I think the way that he played Anderson against the new ball this winter showed that he's beginning to figure it out at test match level. He played it very, very late. He stayed slightly leg side of it to ensure that he doesn't get his front pad in front of off stump. And he played the swinging, seaming ball really, really well, I thought, this winter. And I think when it settles down in England and those short boundaries come out to play, and I mean, he's always scored boatloads of white ball runs in England, I think Sharma is good enough. And that stat about home and away is true, but it's an oddly smallish sample size of his away form, really. I think that this is his time. And I think him and Gill opening in England, I mean, my word, you know, just go and watch that. It'll be sensational.
And Rohit did well in Australia as well. He didn't get like one standout. Yeah. Score, but it's a really good Australia attack. He did well there. Well, anyway, moving away from the Test series, England women beat New Zealand 3-0 in the second game. Freya Davies took a 4-for in a comfortable 6-wicket win. And in the final game, England with Nat Skiver in as captain, Heather Knight was injured. England won that by 32 runs. Probably the most encouraging win of the lot, actually. There were runs from Sophia Dunkley, who batted for the first time in the series. She scored 26. And Fran Wilson scored a quick 31 not out. And Maddie Villiers took 3-for-10 as well. I guess, Ben, we were talking about it on last week's show, about how England have been quite reliant recently on their most established batters getting the big runs for them. So it was good to see Dunkley and Wilson in the runs.
Yeah, and that innings is the kind of innings that Dunkley can play, I think, because she does have this, you know, she's got a power game, she can hit boundaries, but she just understands what a situation demands, I think. And so in that 30-20 when England were, 24-2 with Bowman out, and then 34-3, Siver sort of quite selflessly ran herself out to give the junior partner sort of a bit more time in the middle, I think. And then she sort of, you know, didn't look fluent in making the 26, but also knew that if she could just stick around, if England could get up to past, if they could get up near 130, as they eventually did, then they would have enough in the bowling department to see off New Zealand. And that's the kind of thing that she brings. She kind of knows when to, like, to how to mould her game to the situation. And that's why I think she's so exciting. So yeah, that was really encouraging.
India women were back in action for the first time in pretty much exactly a year. It was their first ODI in well over a year, actually. They were comfortably beaten by South Africa in the first game of that series by 8 wickets. Mitali Raj, who's now 38, scored a 50, but India could only score 177. South Africa chased it down with 10 overs to spare and very nearly won that by 10 wickets after a 169-run opening stand between Lizelle Lee and Laura Wolfart. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
A couple of interesting appointments in South African cricket. Quinton de Kock, who I think it's fair to say didn't give the impression he was enjoying the role all that much, and it seemed to be affecting his form too, has stepped aside. So he's been replaced as Test captain by Dean Elgar, their gritty opening batsman. But perhaps more interestingly, particularly given South Africa's schedule over the next couple of years, which is very much dominated by white ball cricket, is that Themba Bavuma has been named ODI and T20 captain. So he's become South Africa's first permanently appointed black African captain. And all being well, captain his country at 2 T20 World Cups and a 50-over World Cup in the next 3 years. So really busy time for white ball cricket. An exciting time to get the job. He's been successful captain with Lions in South African domestic cricket. And Graham Smith talked about the fact that his leadership qualities have been kind of noticed for a long while now. But he has only played 6 ODIs and 8 T20Is. So it'll be interesting to see how he juggles leading that side whilst also showing that he kind of deserves his place as a batsman alone. But you know, it's another historic moment for South African cricket, and Bavuma was understandably keen not to focus too much on that aspect of his appointment. Captaining your country kind of brings enough challenges as it is without that rather weighty one on your shoulders. But I would suggest his first job should be to get on the phone to AB de Villiers and beg him, ask him for one last hurrah at the T20 World Cup later this year. And then who knows, South Africa could legitimately go on and win it. I think they have got a strong enough side, certainly, to be in the mix. And if you can add de Villiers to it, then I think they could be there or thereabouts.
Yeah, Bavuma's white ball career is almost the opposite of his Test career in that he's had very few opportunities and done really well there. And it's almost been quite strange how infrequently he's played in white ball cricket based on how well he's done. And I guess on Elgar, we talked about potentially Markham getting captaincy, but Elgar is just the most sensible decision, really. One of the only batsmen in that team is actually guaranteed a spot at the moment.
He's also made it clear that he's desperate for it, which shouldn't necessarily count for all that much when it comes to Test captaincy, but they aren't exactly awash with options. He's definitely going to play, and he just looks like a South African Test captain, doesn't he? There's something about him. So that it looks like two very sound appointments. The de Kock thing never really felt right for all sorts of reasons. So I think all parties will be glad that's over. And yeah, it's a tricky job being captain of South Africa for lots of reasons. It'll be fascinating to see how they both go.
My moment of the week was Kieran Pollard hitting six sixes in an over. It was an amazing game, actually. So he hit the six sixes off Akhila Dhananjaya, who had already taken a hat-trick in the same innings. So he goes from an almighty high to a pretty damning low. And the actual moment for me was Ian Bishop on commentary. It had to be Ian Bishop on commentary. And when the final six went over the boundary rope, he said, Herschel Gibbs, you Rod Singh, you have company. And also, Dwayne Bravo scored a 17-ball unbeaten four at the end of that run chase. As a, he didn't have that many wickets in hand, but plenty of time because of those six sixes.
Do you know what, Yes? I'm dead inside, but I found it utterly unremarkable, the Pollard thing. Maybe I'm just too tired of it. I don't know why. But I watched it and I felt no real build up of tension and no real kind of jaw to the floor response to it come its completion. It was such a tiny, tiny little ground. The absence of anybody in it obviously exacerbates this surreality of it, I suppose. It was done with great nonchalance by Pollard, but it didn't feel like a great sporting moment in a funny kind of way.
I don't know what you mean. I think for me, I was almost surprised that Pollard's not done it already.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
But it's a rarity as well, isn't it? In that it's one of those records that is becoming less and less impressive. You know, like every time someone breaks the 100-meter world record, you're like, wow, how are they going faster and faster?
Well, there are reasons for that.
But in terms of this record, I mean, people almost do it all the time now. So when someone actually managed to pull it off, I don't think it's quite as kind of staggering as... Well, it's definitely not as staggering as it once was.
Mm, definitely.
Anyway, we just rained on your moment of the week.
Sorry.
To be honest, it was more the commentary anyway, so I'm all right.
Okay. Well, that was definitely more Brian Blessed than Ian Bishop, your impersonation.
That was good, wasn't it?
I wasn't going to try the accent.
Probably wise.
Yeah. Well, West Indies won that series 2-1. They won a low-scoring decider by three wickets. A couple of good performances from young Sri Lankans. Wilindu Hasaranga, who we saw in the England Test Series, did really well. He took eight wickets across the three games. And Pathum Nisanka, who I've mentioned before on the pod, he got a few 30-odds for Sri Lanka. He's 22, averages 67 in first-class cricket, got 13 first-class hundreds, and is in the Sri Lanka squad for the Test Series. So good chance of him making his debut there. And in New Zealand, the Black Caps took their T20I series against Australia 3-2. Martin Guptill scored 71 in the decider. Isodi took 3 for 24. Ben, what is your moment of the week?
So, yeah, I mean, if this is near the end of the show, it's quite a disappointing note to finish on because it's the Pakistan Super League being postponed due to a sort of a succession of positive tests for COVID-19. There's quite a lot of a dissection of how this actually came about. And then but also, I guess, there's just the ramifications for what it means for the global calendar, which obviously we know is already very squeezed. PSL has sort of had a bit of a window and now is going to really struggle, I think, to find a place to sort of give itself prominence alongside whenever it reschedules. It looks like possibly in May, alongside something IPL, might be an option, which is not ideal, but might be the compromise that they reach. There was a good piece on Crick Info by Osman Sami Adin, looking at the sort of the factors that led to the postponement. So Fawad Ahmed, the Australia leg spinner, was the first to test positive, and it led to a postponement of a game, I think, last Monday. But so he was first started feeling ill, I think, on the Sunday evening, and then he self-isolated straight away, but not all his close contacts did. And then there was a Azhar Mahmood's birthday party, would you believe, where there were lots of people who had been hanging out with Fawad Ahmed, who then went to this birthday party, and it seems like kind of from there it spread. And the piece was really interesting. It talks also about the over-reliance by the PCB on tests, and they would often sort of make a big show of how many tests they had done and say, and that was kind of their kind of safety net. But that meant that that there were lots of concerns over the sort of the safety of the bubble. For example, they were sort of sharing lifts, for example, with people who weren't in the bubble, or they weren't sure if all the hotel staff were properly bubbled up and that sort of thing, or if the cutter was being properly cleaned, or, you know, to point of, you know, biosecurity and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a sort of a sad situation because I was really enjoying the competition. Between that and the IPL as my favourite T20 competition to watch, I think. And now it was sort of just after having such a high octane start to the year for cricket with the England series, or the Australia series, and then the England series, or is it going to have just a little bit of a lull? I know we have the white ball game to come up with, but it's not the all day, every day thing that I kind of need to get me through lockdown, I guess.
just to clarify, I didn't catch that. So there's talk that maybe they can reschedule what's left of the tournament during the IPL.
Yeah, that's been suggested. Yeah.
Oh, that'll be fine. There won't be any comeback from that at all. That'll be absolutely fine. Won't be any concerns whatsoever.
Finally, let's end the show with a Cameron Green Sheffield Shield update. So obviously he didn't have a great start to his test career, but his numbers in the Sheffield Shield this winter, their summer, has been amazing. So in non-test first-class cricket this season, his scores are 56, 11 not out, 197, 7 and 36, 56, 125 not out, 168 not out, and 251. So 907 runs at 129, 400s. That's pretty handy.
Yeah, but he hasn't batted at Ahmedabad yet, has he?
So. He hasn't, no, he hasn't. I think that's all we have for today's show. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Phil. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.